Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Theopolis Podcast. My name is Brian Motz, and I'm assistant to Peter Lighthart, the president of Theopolis Institute, and I'm your host here from week to week. Theopolis Institute trains men and women to lead cultural renewal by renewing the church. Participants in our programs will learn to read the Bible imaginatively, worship God faithfully, and engage the culture intelligently. In this episode, episode 50 of the podcast, Peter Lighthart and James Jordan sit down to discuss the texts for the fourth Sunday of the Easter season. Those texts are Acts 2, 42 through 47, 1 Peter 2, 19 through 25, John 10, 1 through 10, and Psalm 23. To help you follow along with this from week to week, I've included a link in the show notes to the Missouri Synod of the Lutheran Church's lectionary, which is what Lighthart and Jordan have been using along the way. We really hope you enjoy this discussion, and as always, thank you so much for listening.
Welcome to the Theopolis Podcast. I'm Peter Lighthart. I'm here with James Jordan and Brian Motz, and we're discussing the readings for the fourth Sunday of Easter in the lectionary, the Missouri Synod Lutheran lectionary that we're using. That's this coming Sunday, May 7th, 2017. And the texts for this Sunday are Acts 2, verses 42 to 47, 1 Peter 2, verses 19 through 25, and John 10, verses 1 through 10. And particularly in the last two, the thing that kind of binds these together, that holds the room together, is our references to Jesus as the Good Shepherd. The John 10 passage that we'll get to is the great Good Shepherd passage in John. And 1 Peter 2 ends on the same note by talking about Jesus as the shepherd of our souls. And the psalm that's assigned for this Sunday is also a shepherd psalm in keeping with that theme, Psalm 23. And I know, Jim, that's a psalm that you've thought a lot about and have kind of an alternative take on it.
I don't know if it's an alternative take. It might be. I haven't, researched what everybody's ever said. But it is noteworthy, I think, that the very sentimental way of singing Psalm 23 that we have, and that the Trinity Hymnal, for instance, has four different musical versions of Psalm 23, all with the same text, and all with kind of sentimental music, not like what was written at the time of the Reformation, which is pretty martial and warlike. And you can see that if you look at the text again. David says, "If I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil." So this psalm is used at funerals, and appropriately so. But he goes on to say, "You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies." So we're in a battle situation, one way or another. The enemies in the psalms are usually people close to David who are going to betray him. But you can use your imagination and see David out in the boondocks as he flees from Saul, and Saul is coming from the north, and Amalekites are coming from the east, and Philistines are coming from the south, and David's caught in the middle of all this, and his men are nervous and afraid, and he says, "Oh, chill, man. It's nothing to reason, nothing to be afraid. Let's sit down and put some oil on our heads and relax, and because God is going to take care of us." And actually, the thought of preparing a table in the presence of your enemies goes back to when Joshua first brought the people over. They were told to circumcise themselves in front of the watching eyes of the Canaanites in Jericho and expose themselves to the possibility of being fallen upon in that incapacitated situation. And then they were supposed to relax and have the Passover for a week before doing anything, and to trust God. And of course, the Jericho men didn't do anything. So David has a lot to hearken back to suggests that we can relax in the presence of a fearful situation. And it's that fearful situation that's involved here.
Yeah. And that has obvious Eucharistic connotations. Yeah. The church's table is always set in the midst of enemies.
Right.
And the fact that we're feasting in the midst of enemies and in the midst of these threats is a sign of our confidence that our shepherd is able to protect us and guard us from any harm. You have the same thing in the other passages that talk about shepherds in this week's reading. You have the same kind of threats. 1 Peter 2 ends with that reference to Jesus as the shepherd and guardian of our souls, which is that's what's linking that to the other shepherd passages. You were continually straying like sheep, and now you've returned to the shepherd and guardian of your souls. But in the immediate context, right before that, it's talking about Jesus as the one who gave himself for us, bore our sins in his body on the cross. Jesus who suffered insults, who suffered being reviled, who was threatened, but he didn't respond in kind. He returned good for evil. And all that's part of the fact that he's the shepherd and guardian of our souls. But this also, that's in context of an exhortation to Peter's readers. So it's talking about Jesus as the model for believers, but Jesus as shepherd, as the model for the sheep. The sheep follow the shepherd, imitating the shepherd. And that means that we too willingly suffer revilement and insult and opposition and threats, and we don't respond in kind. We follow our shepherd to the cross, and that's rewarded, Peter assures us, if we suffer harm because of stupid things we've done, or if we suffer harm because we've done evil, Peter says there's nothing creditable in that. There's mm-hmm. no reward there. But if we're suffering for doing right, God favors that. He favored Jesus, who suffered for doing right. He favored the shepherd, and he's going to favor the sheep who follow the shepherd in the same way. So you again have the same kind of situation of threat that you mentioned in the psalm is there also in the Peter passage.
Yeah.
And in John 2, that is John 10, John also, John 10, 1 through 10, which is the passage for today, for this Sunday, the gospel text. It's the Good Shepherd passage, and it talks about Jesus as the one who guides and protects and comforts and so on. But it's in a situation of danger.
The doorkeeper opens. You think that's John the Baptist?
I hadn't thought of John the Baptist there, no. But that might be right. John 10 is obviously immediately follows John 9. That's always a good exegetical point, yeah. Exegetical observation. And there's no chapter break. It's all part of one event. You go from the beginning of chapter 9 through the middle of chapter 10, toward the end of chapter 10, and it's all one section. And it's all taking place at the same feast. So John 9, we've talked about recently, is about the man who was born blind that Jesus heals, stoops down and makes clay out of the dust, out of the earth, and puts it on his eyes. And that miracle is over, as usual in John, that miracle is over in a few verses, but it sparks a controversy that then goes on for a very long time. In this case, it doesn't involve Jesus. It involves the blind man as the surrogate for Jesus, who, as we've talked about, is strengthened in his witness. His witness becomes clearer as he's attacked. And then once he's cast out of the synagogue, Jesus is waiting for him at the door outside the synagogue. And that's the setting when Jesus starts rebuking the Pharisees, accusing them of blindness. The man who was born blind is not the blind one. The Pharisees are blind. And in John 10, that immediately moves into the Good Shepherd discourse, which I think that means that what we're talking about, when Jesus is the actual setting of this parable, if you will. The actual setting is with the Pharisees directly in front of him when he talks about entering by the door and climbing over and sneaking in. The hirelings don't protect the sheep because they're hirelings. There are thieves who break in and try to steal the sheep. The wolf comes and the hirelings run away because they're afraid. That all those contrasts that he's making between the good shepherd and the hirelings, the good shepherd and those who spoil the sheep and devour them and attack them, those are contrasts between Jesus as the shepherd of his people and the Pharisees. That's in the immediate context. He's directly rebuking them for their treatment of Israel. There's, of course, Old Testament precedent for this extended parable of shepherds and false shepherds who devour the sheep instead of protecting them. Ezekiel 34 has the same kind of imagery, talking about the kings of Israel, and Jeremiah uses the same kind of imagery. The shepherd is the king, and the false shepherds and false rulers are the ones who feed on the sheep instead of leading them to pasture. So that kind of heightens the drama of the whole passage. And again, puts it in the same kind of setting as the psalm. Jesus is talking about himself as the good shepherd in a situation where he's under attack from the Pharisees. And his actions as a good shepherd involve putting himself between the sheep and the wolf. It involves being willing to lay down his life for his sheep. So being a shepherd involves self-giving for the sake of the flock.
And in the context of John 9, where they have put the man out of the synagogue, it says in verse 3, to him the person who listens, the doorkeeper opens, the sheep hear his voice, he calls his own sheep by name, and he leads them out. So Jesus is leading them out of false Judaism. Mm-hmm. He puts forth all his own when he puts them out. He goes before them. The sheep follow him. So that's one direction of it. Then we shift to Jesus leading them into a new place, I guess we would assume.
Right. Right. Verse 9, anyone enters through me, he shall be saved. He shall go in and out and find pasture. Right. So there's an exodus and an entry into pasture, into a good land. Follows the history of Israel, following the good shepherd, the shepherd of Israel, who is Yahweh. Psalm 80 begins that way. The Lord is the shepherd of Israel, who brought Israel out of Egypt and brought them into the land, settled them, planted them in the land. That's all the work of Yahweh, and now Jesus is identifying himself with the God of Israel, who does that again for his people. Now, you don't have a explicit shepherding theme in the Acts passage.
No.
So that's the one anomaly. We could if we crush it a little, to quote Malvolio, if we crush it a little, we can make it fit. Surely we can make it fit. We can make anything fit. One way to read it in the light of the other passages is to think of the activities of the early church that are described here. This is the flock that's been led to pasture. This mm-hmm. is the flock that's been brought out of the old world, and they brought into the new world, and they're pasturing. The pasture is the apostles' teaching, fellowship, breaking of bread, and the prayers that they're devoting themselves to. And the Lord, the good shepherd, Jesus, has placed them under shepherds. That's part of the imagery of the Good Shepherd passage, and part of the gospel accounts of Jesus and the apostles, is that he's training shepherds to shepherd his future flock.
Yeah.
And so now we see that flock gathered together at Pentecost after the Spirit falls, together in pasture. Of course, we also here have the famous passage of the communist passage in the New Testament.
Yes, Peter.
Which we could put a little plug in or a little teaser in for our course on political economy that's coming up in a couple weeks. Marvin Alasky, who still edits World Magazine, I guess.
Oh.
He was converted because he was a Marxist, an avowed Marxist, and he was reading some text of Marx that quoted this passage favorably as an example of early Christian communism. And Alasky said, I've never read this before. I've never read the Bible before. I'll go look this up. And he started looking it up and he started reading the Bible. And that was the Marx was his Marx was his evangelist to lead him into the Bible and lead him to Christ. So what are your thoughts
usually,
on that?
Usually we explain this by the fact that they all knew that Jerusalem was going to be destroyed. So there's no point in holding on to property. This is a world that's passing away. There might be a parallel here to going to your Egyptian friends and asking for gifts, which you will then use in the Exodus from Egypt. And that's true. I mean, there would be no point in holding on to stuff you have if it's all going to be destroyed. Turn it into cash and get out of town. Mm-hmm. Or turn it into cash and share it with people. I think N.T. Wright in his little comments in here has a good point that it's less preserving your property because of the coming destruction and more sharing together because you're all in a new world. That's not necessarily something that's going to go on. Obviously, it doesn't go on as some kind of a law. But Jesus tells people, sell all you have, because now is the crisis of the world.
Right. And you can.
That's there, but surely there's also an excitement about sharing with one another.
Right. And you can, I think you can kind of extrapolate a couple different levels. One would be if the church finds itself in similar kinds of emergency situations, if that's the setting, then this is a model for how Christians are to behave. So, you know, if Y2K had happened and had shut down technological civilization as some feared it would, the Christian response might. You know, the Christian response would be to share what you have with others rather than hoarding. It seems like the Christian response in Acts 2 is to sell and provide for those who are in need. So you got that level in similar circumstances. And I think you also have at a broader, more general level, this seems to be on one hand fulfilling a hope that's expressed in Deuteronomy there will be no poor among you. The poor are there. Jesus talks about this, and the Old Testament does too. The poor are there constantly as God's, as an opportunity for generosity and charity. But there is also this hope that there would be a distribution of goods that where there would be, it's not egalitarian, but it is a raising of everyone so that nobody's destitute. And we see that the church is fulfilling that hope that's expressed in the Old Testament. So it has a backstory from in the Old Testament coming to fulfillment here, but it also initiates something that runs through Acts and also through, we see it reflected in some of Paul's epistles, where the sharing of goods, sharing of material goods, is part of the way that God is binding together the different components of the church.
Oh.
So you have, particularly Jew and Gentile, Paul's going around the Gentile world collecting for the sake of famine relief in Jerusalem, and he describes that as kind of a reciprocity between the spiritual goods that the Jews have brought to the Gentiles by being the people of God and by producing the Christ, and then the Gentiles reciprocate that by giving material goods to the Jews who are in distress in Jerusalem. So the it's a sharing of material goods for the sake of building up this united body. And it's part of breaking down the dividing wall between Jew and Gentile, that goods are shared across it. And I guess the other another aspect of this might be the think about the common good that is given to the church is the Spirit. They have all goods in common here, but elsewhere we're told that the Spirit is the one Spirit that's given and distributed to all. 1 Corinthians 12, Romans 12, where Paul talks about the gifts of the Spirit. And each of us has a share in that spirit for the sake of the common good. So that's a share in the one spirit. Mm-hmm. And the gifts of the spirit are for the sake of building up one another and building up the church. But if that there's an economy depicted there, that we're given not just spiritual gifts, but material goods for the sake of building up one another. So there's still the economy of the spirit, as it were, is kind of a model for the way that the church, the generosity and the charity that exists within the church. So I think that, I do think that the immediate setting is the crisis that's coming on Jerusalem. But I think you can still kind of extrapolate not to permanent communal goods, but to extrapolate to an understanding of how goods are to be used within the church and how the church is to use the material things that we've been given to build up the body of Christ.
Yes, I agree. I was thinking of two things. One is, I remember when I was young and just married, we would get together with friends and go out to eat, and somebody would pick up the tab. It just didn't make any difference. Nobody was keeping track. And of course, we didn't have kids then. We didn't have responsibilities then. But still, I think it was kind of a Christian motivation that just showed up.
Yeah.
And the other thing, when you were talking about reciprocity, this came up this past weekend where I was teaching on architecture a little bit, and I explained how Israel, as food land, provided food to Hiram Tyre. Tyre, as Havilah, provided stones and trees to Israel. Two different things, and that runs through the Bible. Israel is always a place that provides food, and the Gentiles reciprocate with building materials. And you can't build a temple without both food and stones. So they both go together to build a house of God. And you have something again going on here,
right,
particularly in the period down to 70,
yeah,
while Israel is still around.
So there's a little teaser for our political economy course coming up in a couple of weeks, and there's still room. We've got room if you want to sign up.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of the Theopolis Podcast. For more information and content from Theopolis, please check us out online at theopolisinstitute.com. We have new articles that come out every Tuesday and Thursday on our blog. We also have a media page with past lectures from courses, ebooks, and other free essays. You can also find us on Twitter at @_Theopolis and on Facebook if you just search for our name. If you've been helped by the podcast, we'd love for you to help us out and leave a review on iTunes. It really helps to get our content in front of new listeners. That's it for now. We really look forward to being with you again in the next episode. And as always, thank you so much for listening.